hesitant to discourse. It can only be Millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Millennial X, and I'm now here with Marek and Bog from the Good Old Boys podcast. This is an American, well, it says it right there, an American podcast, but I think we can go into more detail than that. Bog, would you like to introduce yourself and the, well, introduce yourself first, and then we'll go to Marek.
Bog underscore beef on Twitter, and I'm a co-host on the Good Old Boys.
Excellent. And Marek?
Yeah, I'm M-A-A-R-B-L-E-K at Twitter. I'm Mark from the Good Old Boys. And I just want to say, we're not an American podcast. We're a Southern podcast. It's an important distinction to make.
Sorry. See, that's like when people say that Scotland is England. And it's kind of difficult for people to remember these distinctions. I'm aware that there's a big difference. Maybe that's something we can talk about, the North-South divide in America. But first of all, Bog, would you like to talk about the podcast so that people know what it is that they could be listening to?
Yeah, so we're on Patreon, Twitch, and we also have a Gumroad, because you never know what can happen these days. But well, maybe that's changing. But we do a weekly stream that covers the news straight up. I mean, we read the headlines and we talk about them from a right wing angle. Of course, if you subscribe on the Patreon, we also are just a podcast. I don't know if you'd say we're primarily one or the other, but it's basically just, we have two different modes. You'd be surprised the kind of guests that we pull. I mean, we're very blessed. We've had people like Michael Anton or the hottest journalist in America, James Pogue, but then we also have people, very many millennial vets.
Mr. Yarvin,
Distributist.
Excellent. What kind of topics do you cover?
Our primary, loci that everything is kind of based around, which is patronage, which is, I guess just another way to say that is that, I'm sure Merrick must be to some extent I've always been very, very fascinated with, what people would think of as political science 101. I can hardly believe that it's legal. Like, you can just, if you want, you can go buy books at the library that's like how to take over the world practically, how power works, how this kind of thing. And so patronage there's a book by a series of books written by this guy, Bruce Bueno de Mesquita, which he was someone that had no pure political interest. He didn't want to change the world, this and that. He was somebody that wanted to make a lot of money gambling. It's been bigger than ever, these sort of political gambling markets. And so he was like, yeah, I don't care about, all these ideological things. I want to try to find a model of politics that, I can use as a gambler to get rich.
That's interesting. It kind of reminds me of what Academic Agent has been doing. I don't know if you're familiar with him, an English YouTuber, on the mechanics of power, like just without any ideological convictions at all. It's just like sort of Machiavellian, like how does one handle and acquire power? So very, it's a whole thing, because ordinary people never think about this stuff because they don't seek power.
Well, when we started the podcast 5 years ago, there were criticisms that we were talking about like a very simple, like oversimplified model, like a grug brain model of politics. People don't say that as much anymore, because I think a lot of people are coming around to the absolute truth, which is that politics are way more simple than people pretend. It's not complicated. It only, like, all the perceived complications are just cope from people who are not dealt into the system. If you're actually involved in power or even directly adjacent to it, you can see the connections. Like it's very overt, it's very obvious. But if you're on the sidelines, you can just assume, like, well, there are experts here and they're mixing beakers and, you know, in lab coats, and they're making all these decisions based on variables and
rationality.
Right. But, like, that's not what's, like right now, as we speak, our president is, like, furiously signing papers to to pardon and commute the sentences of, like, the absolute worst people who were convicted in federal court over the last 4 years. Like, it doesn't get any more basic than that.
You also, there's this, there are, I mean, that's like, this is especially, and I think this is a lot of the, we have a lot of right-wing, we have a lot of listeners that will come on and they'll start listening, whatever, and they come from more normie, conservative stuff, and they have this, because there are a lot of normie conservatives that, like, I guess, well, they're just basically not included in the political system. There's no one really promising them anything. There's no one doing anything for them. They have no relationships with politicians as such. And so, you know, they're just like picking up the paper and like, this guy seems like a reasonable guy. I'd like him, you know, this person's more trustworthy. What are their political record and things like this? Whereas,
their qualifications.
Right. Just to take a simple example, I don't know how this is elsewhere, but like in America, if you just want to grab someone to be like a diehard Democrat left wing activist, you could just grab an American school teacher. And I mean, they're in
absolutely,
a
yeah
same yeah. Every, yeah. They're going to be in an employee union that directly negotiates with the Democrat Party. Like, they know, like, well, this is, of course, is a funny thing about ideology and stuff. Some of these people that they don't know, they just think that they love the Democrat Party. But some part of them knows that ultimately this is tied into, you know, survival for them. They get paid. I mean, Republicans are much more likely to cut their wages, cut their pay, you know, cut taxes that would end up in their money. They have a direct money patronage relationship. The politician makes sure I get paid, and you know, we're trying to get more days home, you know, more the work from home days, get these going, and bigger retirements and stuff like that.
And by the way, when you talk about they're members of a union, members of a public sector union, so they're negotiating with their employers for, like, collectively our money. It's like it's not a matter of, like, there's a CEO of the county, you know, the county school system who has to you know, account for X amount of dollars. No, they're negotiating with somebody else's money, so it's win-win for them.
Yeah, this is you know, there's a couple of figures we like to use as big examples. You know, there's this guy, just to use an example I was talking about on Twitter earlier today. So there's a guy named Huey Long. Have you heard of Huey Long?
I've heard the name, but I don't know who it is.
So he was this super successful populist in America. He was cut down by assassin's bullet at 42, and he was just like unbelievably, you know, wildly successful politically, like a super, you know, super genius in politics. And the very first American political poll, like a nationwide poll, was conducted by FDR to see how dangerous. How long was FDR president, Merrick?
He didn't quite serve out in the entirety of his three terms, but yeah. 14 years,
which that's, you know, that's an eternity compared to anyone else, and the amount of power he was able to wrangle and all these things that no one was ever able to sort of centralize power as much as him. But there was this guy, and he was and you know, to him, this guy, Huey Long, who was becoming much more popular than him, he was like, well, this guy's Hitler. And it was like, well, yeah, I mean, to FDR, sure. I mean, to FDR, this guy is the devil because he's going to likely take your job. And he would have if he wasn't killed by a bullet. But these kinds of things are a lot of time they're hard for people to understand. I understand that there are people that are motivated beyond these kinds of things. But this explains a lot of politics, done at the give another example. You know, conservatives, they'll say like, oh, you know, look at these poor inner city, poor black people, whatever. The Democrat Party is they don't realize how much they're being I don't know, mistreated or neglected by the Democrat Party. Otherwise, you know, this is hilarious. You know, these people are like, if a politician had ever done a tenth for you as this Republican white guy, as they do for these people, you know, you would be the biggest political activist ever. Like you have no idea how much, you know, PPP loans or healthcare or just straight up checks, just straight up money, just cash. Like, a politician ever given you cash? They never given me cash. No, they've given people like that cash. So for you to say that is frankly ridiculous.
Well, I think that conservatives are notorious for this, especially in America. I think even more in America than in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Republican voters are notoriously naive about the workings of power, but also the fact that politicians are never pandering to them, never giving them what they want, never seeking to get them what they want. Even the Republicans are serving the client groups of the Democrats.
Yeah.
What's the function of not being dealt in for, gosh, since if you wanted to be really wild about it, you could say from the New Deal until now. But if you wanted to be conservative about it, you could say since the Johnson presidency in the 60s. Like, yeah, if you're not dealt into the system, then you're going to be naive about the workings of power because you have no idea how that kind of relationship would work because you've never been part of it. If you're an average white American who's not who's not homeless, who's not so far below the poverty line that you're eligible to receive government benefits, your relationship to the government is paying taxes, and that's it. It's never done anything for you. It's only made your life more difficult. So you can kind of understand how any kind of political theory, any kind of political practice that's just like, okay, we're going to reduce the size of the government by 10%. Well, if the institution exists to just extract wealth from you and give it to other people who hate you, you know, that's not a terrible strategy. It's just not long term. Not going to cut it, and I think that we saw that change happen before our eyes in 2016. You had an election. You had a candidate who was definitely the first one in our lifetimes who offered a positive vision of how the government could work for you if you're not somebody who's already a client of the Democrat Party.
Well, you know, we're sitting here, you know, basking in the vibe shift, as everyone calls it. Everything's gravy. The right wing is taking over, whatever. And everything that's happened, you know, all the money that Elon spent and all the posting and you know, this having this once in a generation politician to lead the movement that, like, has spent like, you know, four decades on TV, you know, in the, like, that's that kind of, I don't know who's going to be next, but it's likely somebody that doesn't have that kind of, you know, media experience and things like that. But you know, that almost went, how many centimeters were we away from a assassin's bullet of losing that? And you know, this came around in the 60s. There was a guy named George Wallace. You ever hear the song Sweet Home Alabama? They say in Birmingham they love the governor. And they did. Everyone loved the governor. They love George Wallace. George Wallace was all the things Trump is doing, and Wallace more explicitly, he would just straight up, he would say, like, white people aren't being treated properly. He said that the Civil Rights Act is going to negatively affect white people and you know, white young people, white middle class people, and of course they got him with a bullet. They didn't kill him. They put him in a wheelchair, and that kind of ended his political. But I mean, he this was in like the late 60s when people saw how he was polling in the Northeast and all these Rust Belt areas that wasn't the Rust Belt yet, that was even still doing quite well. You know, they were like, yeah, we got to do something. You can't talk like this.
He won states in the Democrat Party primary in the late 60s running as a segregationist. Like, that tells you there was still a constituency for this. He was an interesting political character all around. You've mentioned it before. He was like the last major U.S. politician to say these United States instead of the United States, which I guess like a non-American person, that might sound completely...
No, I can tell the distinction. It's actually referring to a set of things, a plurality of states,
right,
as opposed to referring to a singular United States, a single country.
Which I guess you guys can understand because you have, you know, Scotland, Wales, England. In theory, that's how it's supposed to work for you guys, too. Although, like, every nation... in the industrialized world is trying to move towards complete centralization. Kind of undersells it because it's not just about, you know, centralizing within the nation itself, but joining European Union or whatever, and just kind of dissipating authority, making obscuring who's actually in charge, just kind of
devolving. Dissipating is the word for what actually happens, because nobody is held accountable for anything.
Yeah, there was this idiot on Twitter the other day that had this big quote that was saying, like, you know, if AI comes out, that they're this, like, what's so dangerous is that you know, AI, you know, it isn't directly accountable to anybody. You can't fire it. And it's like, well, we're ruled by bureaucrats and all these, like, God, I wonder if, you know, in Canada they have these, what do they call those, judicial council things?
Tribunals.
Yeah. Anyways. But, yeah, it's also ridiculous. But, you know, stuff like, you know, in America, and hopefully we can... It's all very simple. So stuff like, you know, it seems like it's perfectly normal and safe to, or people say in America, they'll be like, well, you know, we're going to take like 30% of the budget for, you know, this major corporation or a state or a nation. And we're going to, underprivileged groups or these kinds of unserviced communities, what are all these bullshit terms, whatever. And like, what makes you a community? Well, it's like voting. It's like voting 75% plus Democrat. That's like all it means. If you have a community of anything, if it's some kind of sexual fetish or race or what doesn't matter what it is. Like 75% plus of people like that vote Democrat, you're an underprivileged community. Now you can be, now you can have this sort of direct patronage relationship with the state.
There are two ways that you can, I mean, you can talk about this. And one is kind of, I won't say the dumb way, but the way you see people do on Facebook and like Fox News, which is just like, can you imagine if the roles are reversed? But it is true that nobody in America ever says the white community, the Christian community. That never happens. Like, that's just not a thing.
The heterosexual community.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this is just not a thing because you're not part of the, what, like, some people have called the, you know, the Democrat Party the inner party of America, and that they have, you know, they control everything, and the outer party, the Republicans, are fake. I'm a little more optimistic than that. I do think it's true that structurally they've dominated since the late 20th century, and people still kind of fall back instinctively into the mode of just trusting them and going along with them. But I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that you will hear people in the relatively near future saying things like that, because like that is part of the vibe shift. No longer being afraid to say that you are actually your own constituency, you are actually your own community, you are your own thing. You don't have to be ashamed of yourself.
Well, this is something that I always find so depressing when white Americans, and obviously the two of you wouldn't say this, but when white Americans say that they have no, that they're just white, or I'm nothing, I'm just a white guy, or whites have no culture, or they actually claim that, yeah, well, I'm just American, I'm just white. It's like I'm the vanilla option, I'm the basic, I'm the default. There's nothing to me. But you can understand that after decades of being neglected and other groups being lauded, that they come to think of themselves in this way as something that isn't worth protecting because it's not a thing.
Yeah, white people are it's so funny because I mean this is one of those questions where it's like if you ask people of other races, they're like, oh yeah, white people are crazy. They'll give you all these sort of things about white people. I mean, like, you know, just off the top of my head, like and this gets lied about a lot. White people invented rock and roll music. I mean, I don't know why anybody would say otherwise. I can show people stuff from the 40s that is just absolutely rock and roll. That's just like one example. And I mean, that like, could you imagine, you know, Asians inventing rock and roll? That's a ridiculous idea.
Maybe the Japanese, but nobody else.
Yeah. But, I wanted, go ahead.
To butt in here, like the trick to this is, and it's the most simple thing in the world. Okay. White colloquially used to just mean ethnic American. So like white was the thing. It's just like the way you would refer to yourself as an American,
which meant basically someone from the British Isles for a very long time.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I mean, millennial might not know this, but Benjamin Franklin, you know, the guy on $100 bill, one of our founding fathers, he said that if you did not come from England, and specifically only England and the British Isles, and like
Denmark and like one part of Sweden.
Was Denmark included? Yeah, Denmark and like the northern coast of Germany, they were the only white people on earth. If like you were from Bavaria, you were what he called tawny. And so he said that these are the only white people on the planet, and that if you let in anybody else, they're going to ruin the country. So yeah, this is what just our word for ourselves. And they did what they always do. They used language to try to bend the fabric of reality, and it kind of worked. They made people like the idea saying like, well, I don't really have a culture. No, that's like saying when people say they don't have a religion, it's like everybody has a religion. And if you tell me that you don't have one, I know exactly which religion you're a part of. If you tell me you don't have a culture, I know which culture you're a part of. You're a part of like, you're part of the greater imperial culture that's existed since World War II. Like you are a part of something, whether you realize it or not, but just.
You're a part of the water that everything else swims in.
Yeah, exactly. And like this, when I kind of have joking said we're a Southern podcast, but the thing about the American South is that it is a little bit different because we do have our own, like, you know, our, obviously we had the Civil War, we had our own like separatist culture. We were they had to integrate us into the American Empire literally at gunpoint. That happened in the 50s. They sent the military into the South to force us to go along with the Civil Rights Act. It's like we're kind of our own thing, although every passing year that sort of fades out. So you it's rare for you to hear a Southern person say that, because you can take pride in like Southern stuff. You can take like quite literally Southern culture. If you go to the American South, like, you won't see, like, the American diner, but you see the Southern diner, you know, the Southern states. This, you know, everything's named after the South. Like, this is a very, like, important part of our identity. And that does kind of immunize you from this, I don't know, this self, like, this self-negation that, that people do. And I, like, vibes are obviously very important. You can convince people to destroy themselves, destroy their culture, destroy their people, destroy their nations, if you can convince them to hate themselves.
Well, it seemed that this was the whole point behind demonizing the Confederate flag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. It's, and like, you know, in the '70s, people just sort of, the Confederate flag is such a big topic. I mean, literally the Confederate flag has never been controversial in my life. I went and looked at, there was a little car meetup. I like to work on, you know, these classic cars or whatever. And there was a guy there, just some boomer guy, regular guy, normal guy. And, he had this very cool classic car, and in the front bump, and, his front license plate is just a big Confederate flag. That's completely normal in the South. That's, and of course,
yeah.
All these bands that were, you know, very, very popular bands. I think Tom Petty is probably the most famous. I mean, we used to play, you know, play these shows. Right behind him was this gigantic Confederate flag. He was, came from not far from where I am. But I do. I have a burning question about this that I'm almost scared to ask. But well, to give you a little bit of background, I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe you know. I don't know. The audience doesn't know. It doesn't matter. But essentially the American South ethnically is primarily the two people talk about is the Cavaliers and the Scots Irish. We'll leave the Cavaliers alone for now. Scots Irish we'll talk about more so right now. And I think Scots Irish are definitely the much higher numbers or whatever. But and
how dare you?
This term Scots Irish is like it's a terrible term. It confuses everyone. No one knows like what the hell it means. Like, I don't know. This is kind of inappropriate for this kind of thing. I don't know if you're able to do this. I'm just going to ask you because I'm curious. Is it possible for you to Google a name of Tim Wakefield?
Yeah, I'll do it just now. I don't know what I'm going to find.
I just want you, this is just a professional athlete. I just want you to look at this guy's face. And I'm just curious. Do you perceive this guy as ethnically Scottish by how he looks?
No, he looks American.
Okay. I was curious because,
but now that you say it, yes, I can see something. I mean, at first he looks American probably because of how he's dressed. But, and you know, there has been some selection. There has been some refinement of that gene pool in America, clearly. Like a German American doesn't look like your stereotypical German. Mm-hmm. Exactly. There has been some evolution since they left the old country. So, yeah, this guy looks, I immediately think this is an American guy. But within that, yes, he does. I wouldn't be surprised to see him in Scotland. I mean, that facial structure, the eyes, yeah, there's something that reminds me of Scotland, yes.
Do you see any, I don't know if this is something that you can see or people say, do you see anything more, Northern Ireland?
Well, I'm not familiar with Northern, I mean, Northern Ireland, this is where this gets really muddy because Northern Ireland is there was a lot of traffic between Northern Ireland and mm-hmm. Scotland,
right?
So, in both directions at different times. So the Ulster Scots are now Northern Irish, but they were once Scots. But it's very possible that they were once Irish before that. So it's rather complicated,
right? Well, see, this is where. This is where I'm going. So, you know, like I trace my answers in what Scots Irish, this is the term we use in America, but it basically means people that left Northern Ireland. They were Ulster Scots. They left and they ended up in the American South in large numbers. And, you know, the story we get, and I'm just curious, I don't know if this is something that people even talk about it, because obviously, you know, you have your own history of things that are very important and stuff like this. But so, you know, the story we get is that there's another name for the people that make up the ethnic the Scots Irish in the American South, and by the way, so most, like, if you see a famous American, there's a lot of politicians, speaking of which, there's some kind of association with high verbal IQ, but you'll have like the current the oncoming vice president, he's Scots Irish, and kind of people like Bill Clinton, you know, and then going back, others like Andrew Jackson and stuff like that. But anyways, so, you know, the story we get is, okay, so, they end up in the American South. They came from Northern Ireland. I checked my own family records, wherever. And yes, the guy left from whatever Derry or whatever place it was up there. But they came from Northern Ireland, where they were, I don't want to offend people, but this is just what I'm not connected. I've never been there. This is what we're told. Essentially, they were sent to Northern Ireland. They were these very, I will just say, rambunctious people that would kind of playing these sort of border games that you often see among border people, where they go steal from one guy's and then they go run back across the other border when they get in trouble. But the idea is that they were almost sent to Northern Ireland like a human pestilence. Like, holy crap, these people are just they're very rambunctious people.
Do you mean like as part of a plantation, or do you mean that they were like transported as criminals? Like they were sent there as part of a plea deal.
What I mean is basically it's a combination of like, okay, you're going to be our foothold in Ireland or whatever, but this is like primarily motivated by these people were causing trouble for people in England. Again, I don't know. Just to quickly finish or whatever. They were the borderers. These were border people. They all were on horseback and stuff because they're running back and forth. They're playing these border games between Ireland and Scotland, and that this is what we all come from. Is putting you on the spot. This is something that's not particularly interesting in Scottish history or whatever. Do you have any insight on this?
No, I don't. I wish I knew more about this, but unfortunately, I don't. I'll just show people that this is a photo of Tim Wakefield. And I'm now going to show a photo of Ali McCoist, who's Scottish.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was a footballer. And there is I think people would probably agree there is a... You can see a resemblance in the facial structure, I would say. There we go.
Yeah, definitely the arch above. There's a fold above the eyes. There's an arch there. I don't know. I use him because Tim Wakefield is like, to me, he's like the most southern looking person I've ever seen. I don't even know if he's from. I'm sure he is, but whatever his facial features are, they're just very, very ethnically Scots, Irish, American.
All right. Well, there we go.
He was a That's Florida man, actually.
Apparently, the surname Wakefield is English, but you know that could have got in there anyway along the generations.
Yeah, and when people arrived in America, you would try to pretend you were. You would change, like, the people didn't want people to know where they were from if they weren't like part of the more dominant English culture. Like they would change their kids' names to like whatever the current king of England was, you know, at the time. They were trying to pretend to be the most English they could be, even if there's still people from the British Isles. But you know, I don't know the cultural. There were some cultural differences there. Yeah, even at that time, between Scottish, North people, the people that were residing in Northern Ireland, et cetera. It's kind of a swing and a miss, but I had to you being Scottish, Scots-Irish, it was an attempt.
As I say, he does, I'm answering honestly, I can definitely see Scottishness in his face, in his features, and other people agree. One person said, I could see him being a bin man in Glasgow. That's like a garbage guy, you know. So yeah, other people are in agreement. Yeah, he could definitely. I mean, there. It's funny actually. It's funny when you see an American who you can like. Oh my God, that looks like a guy. I could imagine seeing him in Edinburgh. I could imagine seeing him in Glasgow, and yet he's in California and has never set foot in Edinburgh. You know, it's a funny thing.
Well, you notice you can't find a picture of you know, one of the things that people call just anybody, white people live in the South, they'll call them rednecks. That's one of the things people say. And part of that, and you can find, there's any picture you find of Tim Wakefield, he looks like a tomato. I mean, and that is something that's very, very Scots Irish. I mean, I'm like that. Like, it's almost like we're not even white as in white the color. We're always red.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's like, well, we wouldn't be if we were where we were, you know, kind of supposed to be, you know, up north, you know, much higher.
Lurking around on the moors or in the dark forest where we belong. I just would have set the record straight. Not everybody in the South is Scots Irish. I'm not Scots Irish. I'm actually Angloid. And it's kind of, there's the kind of a funny thing. This might be really regional, but like I know in the UK, you know, people in Scotland feel a different way about people in even Northern England, right? And there's, I'm sure you guys got the same kind of rivalry that we do.
Yeah,
where, yeah. Like, when I was a kid, legit, I was told that, like, you should watch out for the people with the Mick nicknames, the Scott. And then we're not talking about, like, Irish people, like Scots Irish, who've been here, like, you know, 300 years like us. And, like, you got to watch out for those Micks. They're rednecks. They're the, you know, they're the bad kind of Southern people.
Yeah, it's amazing. See, this is the kind of distinctions that in Britain are now breaking down and merging.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing is happening in America. One thing I wanted to ask you about was, and we've alluded to it several times, that the South is increasingly homogenizing with the North, and also that each state, because it's relevant to that phrase, these United States versus the, The states are becoming very homogenous. I mean, it seems like 30 years ago, 40 years ago, there would have been a lot more to explore. And I don't mean to talk America down or anything. It just seems like there was less homogeneity, that each state had its own identity to a far greater extent than it does today. How true is that? Or am I just talking rubbish?
No, it's absolutely true. Part of it is mass immigration, but part of it is also internal immigration. There are a lot of people have immigrated into the South from the North and the West, especially in recent years. And also mass communication, television, radio before that, really, I don't want to say the L word, but just like, we'll just say progressivism. It has this eternal drive to break everything down into like one big pile of gray goo, right? Distinction's not
global homo.
Yeah, exactly. They don't like distinction, and that has been ongoing forever. Like you know, we have pretty strong Southern accents, but I think that someone like a Southern Zoomers tend to have a lot, I don't know, more universal television, or I guess God forbid at this point TikTok accents than sounding like their grandparents. That's just part of what's going on. Also, the interstate or, you know, interregional rivalries and distinctions are breaking down because it's kind of the same reason. If you go to prison, you know, your prison gang is not based on what state you came from. It's based on, you know, there's like three big groups and you're part of one of them. So as America has been flooded with people who are not even from this continent, people who in the past would have had, if not conflict with each other, problems, political differences, have kind of come together. And we saw in the most recent election, actually, that a lot of the Mexican immigrants from previous years sided with the Republicans and the white people against the newer arrivals. That's just how politics is, how human conflict works, period.
Yeah. Are you? Do you know? Do you know? Have you ever heard of Sammy the Bull Gravano?
No, I don't think so.
He's an infamous American mobster. Been lots of movies made about him, but
Italian,
right? A very, very, very Italian. You know, full-blooded Sicilian in the mafia, whatever. He was he ended up being a mafia rat, and then afterwards, he got involved with some attempted drug deal, and he went to prison he went to prison. And this guy is just, you know, an infamous super Sicilian Italian mobster, or whatever. Well, guess what? You know, in American prison, they don't have a gang for you know, Mediterranean people. Now, you know, he's got Thor tattooed on his sleeves. And, you know, because he had to join a neo-Nazi gang to survive in prison. That's what you have to do. I mean, you know, if you're an American and, you know, something happens, I don't know, you get picked up, you know, this, you know, people like Daniel Penny would be, you know, he would be in the alt-right if he had been convicted, you know.
Well, see, that's the thing, that the media were saying that he was already, you know, that he was, he hated black people and all that.
Yeah.
So ridiculous. I mean, it was obvious that he was just an ordinary guy. I mean, even, I guess, the fact that he was in the army, the media are going to hate that because that means he's patriotic. And, you know.
Yeah, even worse, the Marines, which is like the army on steroids for their purposes.
Yeah. But it was obvious that he wasn't motivated by hatred or whatever. He was just doing his what he saw as his duty, which once upon a time, every guy would have seen it as his duty in that situation.
Yeah, and they've had to do a lot of work to repress that instinct and stop people. I mean, it obviously didn't work because you have someone like Penny who still steps up and does. And every time that somebody like Penny gets acquitted, and more importantly, you know, today he was hanging out with President Trump and Vice President-elect Vance at the Army and Navy football game, like. The more often that happens, the less power they're going to have. These things always operate in cycles anyway. You have crime gets out of control. We crack down on it. Crime goes away. People get bleeding hearts, and then, you know, the cycle begins anew. But the American view on vigilantism, and it's not really fair to call, like, Penny. I don't even like calling him a vigilante because, like, he really was just trying to restrain this guy. But, like, you can tell how things are going politically in America by how celebrated and how much people like vigilantes. Like, we're starting to move into the Charles Bronson era again, don't you think, Bogby?
Well, that, you see, I did actually watch quite a lot of those vigilante films at a certain time in my life. I don't know why, but... like 20 years ago now, actually. I can't believe how time flies. But anyway, there was a spate of vigilante films in the mid, like Death Wish ripoffs. Because there was that one, and then there were lots of imitations of it. And so from the, like, 74 to the early 80s, there were a huge number of vigilante films that were hilarious, sort of, but I say hilarious because they seem over the top, but it's possible they weren't over the top, because it would always be some low life criminal would be let off by a liberal judge. Mm-hmm. So then some burnt out ex cop would take matters into his own hands and then go and deliver justice on the streets, kind of thing, which is very dramatic, but also so satisfying to watch.
Oh, it's, you know, I do these, I have these sort of, one of the ways I like to use Twitter the most is I use the search function, and there's, it's funny because, you know, all leftists are NPCs. They just kind of say the same things over and over again. So, like, in any given time, I can just go find a leftist that said something in, like, the last 5 minutes that whatever I want, if it's one of their phrases or whatever. And one of the ones I would used to do is, there's this thing that leftists will they'll just tweet this all the time. They're just all independently, they just come up with this and say this, and it's very funny. What they'll just do this tweet. They'll say, like, why do I see all these white men that just randomly have Punisher stickers on their trucks? And I would always, and, you know, I'd always quote tweet and say something like, don't worry about it. You know, Punisher being like the most famous sort of comic book, you know, he enjoys kill. Like, Brian, this gets, they've tried to do everything they can to try to stop him from being this in the same way of who's the guy from the guy with the Rorschach. The same way that the creator of Rorschach, who's also this, has the same kind of thing. He's like, stop, you know, liking this character. They've done this so many times, the Punisher, but they can't do it. But
They solved this the last time because they made, you know, there was a Marvel television show. He wasn't even the main character on it, but everybody loved him so much that they gave him his own TV show. And if you watched the first season of it, it was entertaining. It had some cringe moments, but like for the most part, it's the Punisher just blasting people who deserve to die. And they got so much criticism for that like they intentionally effed the show up in the second season. Like they made the bad guys are like a religious conservative CEOs or something like that.
It sounds similar to what they did with Joker when they realized that white men were identifying with a character, so therefore they had to mess it up to corrupt that so that it wasn't giving them. I mean, God, it's incredible to think that this is how much the media is at war with us. That when something is helping us, and nourishing us and encouraging us, they stop it and pervert it. It's unbelievable.
Absolutely. Almost every vigilante movie ever made has gotten terrible reviews from critics. If you look at what they said about Death Wish at the time, they hated Death Wish. They hated every iteration of the concept. If you want to have fun, just go look at contemporary reviews of Death Wish and then look at like contemporary movies of reviews of a movie like Pretty Baby, which is it was like Hollywood child pornography. And, you know, the critics, I won't say they loved Pretty Baby, but they were like, oh, this is a very artistic film. It made me uncomfortable. And like, they had Death Wish is fascism and crap like that. Like, yeah, they, I think the vigilanteism scares them on a very on a spiritual level.
I think this is something that's quite peculiar to America. And I don't really know why, because white men do intervene in Britain and Germany. I've seen this happen. It's been in the news that some guy saved the day. But in America, there seems to be perhaps it's the pioneer instinct that maybe that's part of the psyche, part of the culture. It's still even now. So when a white man sees something wrong, or someone being victimized, someone being hurt, there's a certain impetus to intervene and put things right. But that is how civilization is maintained. So if you're a subverter, and it's not institutional, it's spontaneous. It's spontaneous maintaining of civilization. So if you're a subverter, that's something you definitely want to attack. As much as you want to attack institutions and undermine those, you also want to undermine this instinct that's in potentially every single white guy.
Yes, this absolutely exists. Oh, by the way, they also did this with Dirty Harry. Dirty Harry, I'm pretty sure this isn't even in the first one. They try to hire a woman on the force, and he gives this like long, like straight up, you know, you know, it could be a YouTube MRA rant about women in the workforce and stuff. But in the second movie, they were like, okay, we made a ton of money off Dirty Harry. Let's time to do Dirty Harry 2. The studio said, there's like, you have to make white people the bad guy in this movie. You just, you have to make cops the bad guy in this movie. There's no way we can just do this again.
I want to run this by him because what he just said reminded me of it. Back in August of 2023, we were having this Twitter discussion about what is an American, you know, American ethnos or whatever. And here's what I said, and you can tell me if you think that I'm right or wrong on this. An American is an English religious fanatic, heavily armed and prone to bouts of both spiritual ecstasy and vigilante violence, psychotically optimistic compared to his ancestors and annoyingly obsessed with money. Does that sound about right to you, Millennial?
That's about five different American archetypes rolled into one.
Like that is really who we are. So like, yeah, like the vigilante thing in the same way that the subverter, in his essence, has to undermine everything around him, like Americans are just down with vigilanteism. Now that doesn't like remain true forever. There's just things magic soil. If you replace all the people in America, that won't be. But like the basic model American, we like vigilanteism just like a little bit more. Than other people, than Europeans. We're just less domesticated.
Yeah, I think it links to the Second Amendment as well. I mean, if you have guns, if you're armed, the general citizenry is potentially armed, every single one of them potentially, then obviously that means they're not reliant on the police, the institutions, to deal with crime. They can do it themselves there and then. So that opens the door to vigilante. I mean, if you do that and then you object to vigilantism, you're rather retarded, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also just the nature of living in, on the frontier and things like this. I'm mm-hmm. sure there must be similar things among, like, you know, the South Africans and stuff like that. But there's also this, you know, element that remains from the naval tradition, like they have their own sort of legal tradition, like of, you know, they hang the guy because crimes, you know, many people were spending all this time at sea or whatever, and crimes were committed that kind of thing. But I don't know how much the idea that we get in America is that the United Kingdom in general is more dominated than most. Like, you know, we have Los Angeles, we have New York City, but the United Kingdom is just London is a monster and has been a monster for a very, very long time. For I understand, London has always been huge, which, you know, that's not necessarily the case for a lot of American cities
the proportion of the population in the United Kingdom that lives in London is out of whack compared to the United States.
I think even compared to like continental places or whatever, that London has just always been a monster.
Was that a question?
Sorry, I was muted. I was going to look at the population of Berlin just so that I would give you a good comparison. Berlin is 3.4 million. I'll have a look at Paris. It's 2.1 million.
Wow.
I think London is it's nearly 9 million.
Holy shit.
It is huge. And certainly it dominates Britain. There's nothing else even close to that. Mm. Let me just look at Manchester. Manchester's only 550,000. Yeah. It's nothing.
Wow.
And indeed, when you go to so Birmingham is 1.1 million. But when you go to Manchester, if you're familiar with London, yeah, and then you go to Manchester, I'm sorry to say this because it sounds insulting, but I don't necessarily mean it as an insult, but I don't mean it as an insult. And it might not even be a bad thing. If you're familiar with London and you go to Manchester, it just seems like a village. It's tiny. Like the center of Manchester just seems tiny because London, it would take, I don't know, a day, maybe several days to walk across it. If you were to walk from West London to East, I don't know how long that would take, but it's a long, you would see countless things on the way that used to be villages that they've all merged together. That's how London came to be. Every one of these different areas. So yeah, London is huge. That's the so, the conclusion there.
So, you know, the name of our podcast, Good Old Boys, it's like, what's funny is, like, you know, like every 6 months there's a new podcast that's been started called Good Old Boys. It is this kind of common phrase, but, you know, it does have meaning with us, you know. So, like I said, one of the things that our show is kind of based on is like political science 101. And it just struck me one day, I was like, wait a minute, something that's just like very much a part of our lives that you don't even think about. You know, when you're reading about, you know, things like a patronage network or something like that, I was like, wait, if you look up patronage network, one of the phrases for it is the Good Old Boys Network, right?
Good Old Boys Club. Yeah.
And, you know, it has all these ways that it affects politics, but it's generally considered in like, generally you're talking about like, there's different networks, which, by the way, you know, in America, like, Harvard has people and Yale has people, but even with Harvard, well, Harvard has the Skull and Bones, and then there's this other group and there's other group, and they're all sort of doing this thing. And, you know, one day we were talking about British politics, and I just thought about it, and I was like, there's almost like none of this, it almost like it doesn't apply, because it's like, because England is so centralized, like literally, like, if you're in the halls of power there, like, and I'm sure this is not still the case, but regardless, for a while, whatever, it's like, there's ones, you know, that you went to Eton, but more importantly, like, all these people that are in power there, they just like literally just know each other as almost like, they've always known each other. Like, they have each other's cell phone. Like, this guy owes me $20 because it's so unbelievably centralized. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they might know each other from school. They would have gone to Eton, rugby. I'm trying to remember the other, Winchester, Marlborough. There are a small number of private, like, elite schools that they would have gone to, and they would have gone to university in either Oxford or Cambridge.
Yeah.
So it is, but it's a smaller country.
Sure.
Much more densely populated. But yeah, there is no rival power center to London. And anything that's, even now when it's all, you know, diversified, everything is still centered in London, with the exception possible of the BBC, which has a big center up in Manchester. But I think the BBC is still actually headquartered in London.
I don't know, we'll keep talking about British politics here for a little bit, even though obviously we're not experts on it. But I don't know how, and obviously you're Scottish, but still, I don't even know how Europeans feel like this, but it's almost like, well, I don't know. I don't really care to some extent if they take exception to this, because I know that there is a lot of exception taking this, like, you know, like, people think of like an annoying American guy living in Boston that walks around with the with his Irish stuff shirt on, but he's not really Ireland. But like, obviously Britain has had a pretty tumultuous past couple of years, more so, like, I don't know if you'd say slightly, but certainly in the same key, you know, all the same kind of things, but it seems like more intense than America. And as Americans, or just, I don't know if it's just white guys, I don't know if it's white Anglo guys or whatever, people in our sphere, we get really upset when we see things being bad in the United Kingdom. And like, and I don't know what to, it's absolutely not the same as showing us some other foreign country. Yes, it does.
No, I mean, if we were in a Black Sea Greek colony and something bad was happening in Athens, we'd be mad about it, because, like, we are, you know, we're not Athenian, but we're cousins. Yeah. So yeah, it definitely, like, I don't give a shit what happens in France, but I do care about what happens in England, and to a lesser extent, the rest of Britain. Yeah.
I mean, I care about France, but it's definitely much less so than England. I mean, it's obviously, this is not just rhetorical. I mean, who's the guy that's the leader of the Reform Party there?
Nigel Farage.
Yeah, I mean, I know that some people he's popular with, some people he's not in our spheres, but of course, you know, he was at Mar-a-Lago after Trump's victory, so it's not just rhetorical. I mean, there is this heavy connection. What do they call it, the special relationship or whatever?
Yeah, yeah, and that connection is very real, because when British people and American people talk, it's very easy. I mean, there's no real... I mean, obviously there is a difference, but it's very surmountable. And just enough difference to make it sort of interesting, because we've got unique things to say to each other. But yeah, there's clearly a connection. And that's partly why a millennial is always... It always has so many Americans on it, and Canadians. Because I've always wanted to cultivate that. But I think it's something that no one ever really complains about it either. No one ever says too many Americans this year. I think I've only had that once or twice.
I'm kind of surprised by that.
There's quite a lot. Yeah. There's quite a lot of brotherly feeling about this, I think. I mean, obviously people will say things about America. But then when it comes to it, I think they do care about it. They do care about the Americans.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, your cousin, my cousin, we might argue. When a British person criticizes America, I'm like, oh, I'll throw the tea in the harbor and all that crap. But when it comes down to it, you know, what's the Arab sayings, like me against my brother against my cousins and I against the world. Like, yeah, like that is obviously just part of human behavior. And it is true. Like, I strongly believe that Americans, actual heritage Americans, like we're like literally obviously Angloid people, but like we're still to some extent English. It's just how we are. There's no way that you can look at what happens to England and not care if you're an actual, you know, non Ellis Island American, if you're like an actual American.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, why wouldn't there be that common feeling? The only real answer to that is that America becomes so diverse that nobody has these roots anymore. No one feels these roots anymore. But I think that's a long way off just now.
Yeah. I mean, if you looked at the stats up until very recently, like I think the 70s or 80s, it might have been crept in the late of the 90s. Like most people who lived in America had like came from people who were colonial settlers of the United States. Like despite all the huge Ellis Island waves that we had, still most people were actually heritage Americans. Now, we honestly, this is the funny thing about immigration here. We don't really know how many immigrants are in America. Like, they've been saying we had 10 million illegals for like 30 years. So that's obviously not true. So people can argue it might be 20 or 30. It might be like 50 million. So we don't know. And as people in Canada or Australia or really anywhere in Europe can attest, it doesn't take like, you know, one or two generations of that, and your country is completely different. Your mentality is different. Your culture is different. Your biology is different. Everything. You're just no longer the same people anymore.
Yeah.
So and that special relationship can't survive that.
Yeah. I mean, it can only be that way as well. I mean, this is how blood matters and genes matter, because people are, it's in the back of your mind. You're always aware of it. And so this is why it's ridiculous to claim that a country will not be changed by its demographics changing. Of course it will. And even the thoughts of the people will be different. And that's demonstrably true. And the left will admit that that's true when they celebrate diversity. But then they'll deny it when it's expedient to do so. I mean, it's so tedious.
Can I ask you, so I've always been under the impression that Scotland – politically is, I would say far, but maybe I'm wrong about that, but more progressive than like England, correct?
Yeah. So that's true.
Do you still live in Scotland right now?
No, I don't.
It's like,
a long story.
Somebody really, really based, like in American context, somebody who's really right wing based, but they live in like in Boston or something.
I know a few.
Yeah, exactly. It happens, and you get like a very particular kind of attitude when you're I won't say stranded, but we're in a place where like the political vibe is vastly different than the way you go about things.
Yeah, I don't know how people stand it. I mean, I know students who are in Boston and off our stripe, and I just don't know what. I guess it's just part of. They just take it as for granted that that's what they're going to be dealing with, and they're used to it. When I lived in Scotland, the unique thing, the very important factor here is that Scotland at that time hadn't had much mass immigration at all. Mm-hmm. It had your average Scottish person had very little experience of non-white people. And very little experience of being outnumbered by non-white people. I mean, that would be extremely rare, an extremely rare experience for any Scottish person to be in a place where they were the only white person. Extremely rare. I left Scotland in 2017, and since then it's had a lot of diversity. It's had a lot of mass immigration. And every time I go back, I see the change. I see a visible change, especially in Edinburgh.
Well, the left has perfected this thing. We've seen this we saw this big story this year with the election with the Haitians and this small community in Ohio. I was thinking about this in a different context. You know, one of the big moments of this year that was kind of like it was. The reaction has to be more complicated than like if you're a normie conservative, you're just like, well, this is just bad all around. It's very simple, but this had a much more complicated reaction, which is kind of common among reactions to this certain politician. Who is the Somali politician, Minnesota? Ilhan Omar. So I don't know if you saw this story. She was at, they had like some big cookout rally day for the local Somali population who had, the government, the Democrats, the NGOs, they had sort of orchestrated like, packing all
the
these,
roast.
Packing all these sort of Somalis in this one centralized location. When you do that, you don't need 61%, you don't need 51% of the population to take over. You know, if you're all like really, you know, you all speak the same language and stuff. I mean, you can kind of run things with like 15-20%. This goes back to just the centralization we see all over the West. I mean, like, I don't know if there was anything particularly liberal about, we'll say, like, major cities in America. And they realized, like, well, if we build these big ghettos in the cities, we can, fill them full up with these black people, then we can organize their votes with these civil rights leaders, and you can sort of exert a lot of control with far less amount of effort than just sort of appealing to this broader people.
But you could literally organize the minority, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And they don't even in a lot of these places in America they don't have these things like signature. There's no ID or signature match. So like you could. Yeah. If you're an activist, you could just literally just know the names of everyone that lives in these ghetto buildings. You could just submit ballots with their names.
She did something that was kind of scandalous for our politics, but might just be
interesting. Common
in the UK, which is what she was speaking to people in her native tongue. And when she speaks English, she's doing the common woke university bullshit. When she talks in her own language to her own people, she says stuff like, I think she quite literally said that like her goal was to get stuff for the Somalian people and to do things in Somalia.
I'll tell you something. In Germany, they've got a huge Turkish population.
Mm-hmm.
And the Turks vote in the national German elections, the Turks tend to vote left, like hard left, far left.
Sure.
But they were able to vote in the Turkish, a Turkish referendum, and they voted hard right. Mm-hmm. for something to do with Turkey.
Sure.
And the same thing has been seen with Turks in the Netherlands and in Austria. They vote for the hard left, within those countries. But with when again with their own with Turkey, it's their hard right. It's really amazing.
When they care about what they care about, everybody's conservative about what they care about. When it comes to like voting on whether or not you should be able to just leech money from a foreign government, yeah, of course, just sign me up. If I lived in Sweden and they asked me like, "Hey, would you like unlimited Gibbs?" Sure, that's cool. And then if I was voting overseas in an election, I'd be voting for like we'll say Giga Trump, so we don't get in trouble. But yeah.
But more interestingly, like she would first off the guy that introduced her said, like, literally he was like, he said that Somalia now has like a legislator implanted within the American government. And then she gets up and she brings up, you know how I think this is more common, like in the Balkans, all these different Balkan countries, they'll kind of troll each other by posting these maps. It'll be like Greater Greece or Greater Romania. That's like, you're just posting a map, but you're also saying like, we want to, you know, take back this land or whatever, you know, we want to conquer you guys.
Oh yeah. It's blood and soil nationalism for your own people, for your own kind.
Yes, and she literally brought up a Greater Somalia. She said we're going to restore Greater Somalia. She said she was talking about we're going to take back this land from Djibouti. What states are nearby Somalia? Like, I mean, this is like, that's not even just like normal. Like, we're all the same ethnicity. Like, this is like you'd have to be. If you were like in the Greek context, you know, most Greek people don't know about the Greater Greece restoration movement. I mean, no, this was like some hardcore ethno-nationalism.
Yeah, she's talking about like the school to prison pipeline in America, like in English, and then she switched over to her language. Like, I'm going to create Greater Eritrea. We're gonna conquer all of our ethnic enemies. That like the what's the name of the British conservative? She's the Yoruba lady, Kim something, right?
Kemi Badenoch.
She had an interview recently where she said like, "Oh yeah, I don't like to be called Nigerian. I'm Yoruban. The people, other people in northern Nigeria are my ethnic ethnic enemies." that would be based if it was she wasn't the spokesperson of the Conservative Party in Britain, and she's a Yoruban nationalist.
Exactly. And this is the whole thing, that she will demand that race be irrelevant to us. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't care about ethnic identity, history, our land, our home. We've got to welcome everyone. But meantime, she identifies. And you know, it's just human nature. She's only doing... of course she should identify with the Yoruba. Why not?
She'd be doing it in Nigeria is the problem.
Well, exactly. I would have no problem with this. It's the fact that she's here where it doesn't work. And secondly, the fact that she's simultaneously demanding that we don't have this same feeling that she's proudly proclaiming she herself has. It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I'm gonna be the ugly American here and say this is one of the essential problems with the Westminster system and versus like, you know, you could say whatever you want about our American democracy being imperfect, but because we elect the leaders, we chose Trump. The Republican Party would have never allowed Trump to be the nominee. They would have never chosen him. That we did, we forced them against their will twice to do that. Like. If the average Tory voter got to decide who the leader of the Conservative Party would be, they wouldn't pick her. And like that's the one thing I really don't like about your system. Like it has to be you're voting for a man, and I don't mean that. I do mean that literally too, actually. Like, you need to be able to vote for the man, not for the party. Because when you vote for the institution, then once it's captured, you're beyond effed. There's just nothing you can do. And I'm not saying that our system is good. We're always on the verge of utter destruction here. But you've always got a shot in America because, like, one guy can wield an insane amount of power in our system, and he gets the people get the way in.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm generally against party politics completely, party mm-hmm. democracy. I just don't mm-hmm. think it's a good way to run things, because it leads to this ridiculous tribalism where people are attached to the party that their dad voted for, their granddad voted for, they've always voted for. Why? And then the party's free to betray you completely, just like we were saying earlier, that conservatives are betrayed by the GOP constantly, and yet they keep voting for it. Well, as a sort of loyalty.
I mean, not sort of, but okay. Like, up until if you were my mother's age, everybody in the South voted for Democrats. In fact, one time I had a conversation with my great grandmother, who lived to be almost 100, and she was talking about how, you know, her dad and her grandfather, everybody in the South was a Democrat forever. And she told me the only time that anybody in our family voted for Republican president was when the Democrats ran a Catholic in the 1920s. And she said, her dad said, "I'll be damned if I'll ever vote for a papist." And he broke that string of like 100 years. So like, but we did in mass switch over to the Republican Party. Like, you're completely right about the travel stuff. However, it's not immutable. Like, people can switch their loyalties. And Trump is the perfect example of this, because there are a lot of people now who are personally loyal to Donald Trump who are not loyal to the Republican Party. And I hope that trend continues forever, because that is the best way that's the only way to really do politics. Like, you can be loyal to a person, you can be loyal to his entourage, to his successors. But once you're loyal to a party, like, I mean, in the American context, it's like, am I loyal to Lindsey Graham? No. Like, that's disgusting. Donald Trump? Sure. And I hope that Americans can figure out that distinction, because, like, really, time is running out for everybody.
Oh, definitely. Well, that gets us neatly to talk about the vibe shift. This is something that you mentioned earlier. Obviously, Trump has just won the election, second time he's going to get in. What and that has attendant effects. He isn't even in power yet, but certain people have said that they detect a vibe shift. So, yeah. Bog, would you like to take that?
Yeah. So this is so. The people, so occasionally we get to talk to people that have been like in the quote unquote halls of power. People have been like in these, you know, high level NATO meetings and, now Mar-a-Lago, Washington DC and stuff. And they've told us that there is a definite vibe shift, that there's a lot of cringy things that people used to say. I mean, I think people that are doubting this, and I have many doubts as far as whatever the strength of this, but as far as even if we're just talking about superficial things, people don't remember how dominant the libs felt in, say, summer of, say, 2022. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the libs were just, they felt like we never have to listen to the American people ever again. We can do anything we want. This is when they had, you know, this trans stripper outside the front of the White House with the LGBT flag stretched outside. They were just putting their nuts on the dresser and be like, what are you guys going to do about it?
More we can do anything. A lot of our people believed it too. That was more important than them believing it.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, the people were very demoralized. I mean, it seemed very scary. These people seemed like they were like, it was a very blackpilling time. People felt like these people, and that was before they smashed the right in the midterms. So that's around, you know, I'm guessing there's a lot of things that the left does that are just so embarrassing, you know, shit, just it's not really all that politically relevant. Especially if you listen to this, you're, you know, you've, you've graduated past seeing like woke freak out compilations or so, you know, but you know, stuff like that. The what's the thing where they say where the Indians who should own the place,
land acknowledgement. Well, you know, Benjamin Boyce was on just a little bit ago, and he kind of he was the first person I ever saw to really videotape in detail all this crap that was happening, the land acknowledgements and people, you know, announcing their pronouns.
Yeah.
He was at the ground floor of that.
Yeah. And American professionals in particular, I mean, we're not professionals, so I think a lot of this stuff is a lot less pressure. But these people were very, very scared of that stuff. Supposedly that stuff has changed. Now, of course, you know, literally, obviously, Trump isn't even walked in the White House. What has changed with, say, you know, the law, civil rights law, you know, leaders of, you know, these major the universities, firms and stuff like that? Not too damn much. So, and yeah,
none of it. But here's the thing. Okay, yeah, he's not president yet, but they're treating him like he is the president. They did the, you know, they do the polls about what how people feel, and he's got the highest ratings he's ever had. Our current actual, you know, elected in quotation marks president is like a senile old man. He's just kind of been, they stuck him in the nursing home for the last, you know, for the last 2 months. Trump's walking around and they're treating him like he is the president. That doesn't change, like you said, that doesn't change the law. It doesn't change institutional power. What that is an opportunity. And like vibes do matter because people will either fight back or bend the knee depending on how they feel that the winds are blowing. And especially people who work in the bureaucracy. Now, some of them are you're going to be intractable enemies of everything good. That's just who they are. But there's a lot of them who they get along. They go along to get along. And those people you can deal with if you project an image of strength and if you act decisively. What Trump has is an opportunity. And you know, we don't have a great track record with that. Reagan came in with a huge, like a much bigger mandate than Trump has electorally. And not only did he not do anything with it, like Reagan was elected to overturn the Great Society, to undo the damage of the Civil Rights Act. And he not only didn't do that, but he entrenched it forever. And he also gave amnesty to a boatload of illegals. Similarly, Obama came in with a mandate. The jury is still out on how well he used that. And Trump's coming in with one now. And if his people are smart, if they know how to use lawfare, if they're willing to actually go to the mat to roll back some of this stuff, don't be confused. There's a very short window to do this, like less than a year. If that first year he's in office, if they act decisively, if they actually do some of the things that they're threatening to do, and these aren't like politicians will lie about stuff all the time, but like these are things that they don't need to lie about. Like it's a no-brainer to use executive authority to remove your political enemies from positions of power and replace them with your friends. There's no reason for you not to do that if you can. If they do those things, then the vibe shift will become an actual shift, and you can go from there. You can parlay that into something that is lasting and something that could, in theory, correct some of the problems of the 20th century that we're still dealing with. Like I said, though, the track record is very bad. The right in America has been a joke for at least like 80 or 90 years. But there's no point in dooming about it. You might as well be optimistic because really, what choice do you have?
Well, yeah. I just want to real quick, the thing with the vibes, and a lot of people some people, obviously our podcast isn't for everybody. One of the things people will criticize, they'll say, like, you guys always keep bringing up basic stuff all the time. And I, I, I certainly do, and I think that we have a sort of basic problem with the human brain. All I know is my brain, because it's the only one I got, and I know that it's very hard for me to keep reminding myself of simple things. So I bring up simple things all the time. I don't think that there's a problem with it. But like, what do vibes matter? Just give a simple. This is a simple example, but I think it's good because it's simple. If you're a young male, you're listening to this, you know, you must be interested in war. We all like, you know, especially like, medieval war, Renaissance war, the Roman Empire, all this kind of shit, which I do myself too. One thing that you'll find is that, you know, there are some great battles of, you know, Roman history. Well, that's my favorite, but, the thing that you'll find is that all war just becomes, we'll just keep it to the old stuff. But, you know, all war, the great battles that we think of, they're all very much exceptions, because all the war that's outside of the great battles, you know, when you think of two armies taking the field and the scouts move in and the flanks move in and they start out, you know, with peppering with arrows and stuff. That's all very rare, because the only reason that ever happens is because someone is overestimating. Someone doesn't realize that they're outmatched. Humans generally, like, you know, we don't need, we use vibes to predict what other people are going to do, so that, people don't have to hit it. Otherwise, people would just, you know, your father, you know, does he just immediately pull off his belt and start beating you when you do something wrong? Or does he, he can just give you a look that says, hey, you know, you're fucking up. You should probably change your mind. Now, the idea is maybe you would get your ass beat if you continue down this road, but you're always kind of trying to predict these kind of immediate reactions to our own behavior. That is vibes, and that is how most things work. You can be fooled. This is why I definitely believe what do they call the thing where they try to make people less optimistic.
Disillusion, demoralization.
Demoralization, like people say that this is what the left is trying to demoralize. Absolutely, I definitely believe demoralization. That's kind of like the lowest cost waves. It's like you don't want to have to put people from, you know, Trump supporters in jail. You'd rather just people scared. Like, gosh, I'm not sure if the vibes are cool for that. I'm not sure I should say that. I'm going to get in trouble. That kind of thing.
And but then we need accountability here, because that thing that you said about pitched battle being a mistake, that was extremely Yankee coded and demoralizing to the Southern spirit.
Well, I mean, it's they thought that they could win. That was
stuff we were good at, bro.
We were. I mean, well, I'd say we were. Well, we were. We lost that war. We won the guerrilla war afterwards. But but yeah. Sorry.
All right. I mean, it's nice to hear this, because other Americans who've been on have been quite pessimistic about the chances of Trump doing anything. Really, it seems to me. Again, I'm an outsider, but it seems to me that he's probably going to do at least something. I mean, because he's explicitly said, like, this is not, I mean, I guess you could say that the first time around he did promise to build the wall. That was an explicit promise, and he didn't do it. In this case, he's made quite a raft of promises. I don't know. It seems to me, it just seems to me as an outsider that it's different this time. Now, obviously, some people
say, they tried to kill him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They tried to kill him, which again signals to me that, okay, maybe part of the regime has sided with him and made peace with him, but part of it definitely hasn't. I mean, there clearly were moves to prevent him from running for president.
I think people can be very valuable, useful, and effective, and have completely different personalities when it comes to this. I always think of there's two guys that are pretty similar in kind of what they're doing. Well, who's the Blackwater founder?
Eric Prince.
So Eric Prince, like, you know, his sister worked for Trump. He's a billionaire. He's been in, you know, he owned a company worth millions. He's not all that much different than Trump in terms of you know, being this effective, powerful, successful person or whatever. They'll probably work together at some point in the administration. And then you have Trump. You know, someone like Trump, you know, Trump literally doesn't worry about anything ever. You know, he's like, he said that before. You know, this is one of the problems. You know, they had all these trials. They were going to take him to all these trials and stuff. He's like, yeah, I don't worry about it. It was like, you know, I'll be fine. You know, I'll figure it out. That's just kind of his personality. Trump doesn't worry about anything. You know, he gets shot in the head. He's fine. It'll be great. It'll be fine. He's just not a worrying person. You think about Eric Prince, who I also admire very much. Eric Prince is worried about everything all the time. I mean, he's, you know, just spiritually like a doomer. You know, he's like every week he posts on Twitter, like this huge list of like everything in the world. That's like, you know, he's like, oh, you know, the talks between Myanmar some country nearby. What am I thinking about? B name country near Myanmar. Burma? Anyway, Burma, they could break down. This could lead to, you know, they could break down leading to this. And you're thinking like, you know, he's worried about everything all the time. And he's able to use that and be that's able to be effective for him. You know, there have been a lot of really, really, really great leaders who have died in office, who've been very, very good at politics, who have been essentially like turbo paranoid. They think everyone's out to get them. They think everything's going to be a failure, and they're able to be super effective. I don't think I'm taking extremes. I'm not saying you have to be one or the other, but so I try to accept that people are able to be effective, white pill, black. I don't chide people. They say you have to be white pill. You have to be black pill. That's just how I feel about that.
You remember Herodotus when it was Darius, I guess, he had like a servant or administrator just, you know, hey, remind me at lunchtime like three times to destroy the Greeks, to wipe them off the face of the earth. I'm a busy guy, sometimes I forget things. Just reminding me every day that I need to destroy them. Like, that's what a guy like Eric Prince's job is. He's sweating the details, like, do we need to intervene in Sumatra? And like, yeah, Trump is the exact opposite of that. Trump never worries about anything, which that can be a problem, but on the other hand, it also leads to stuff like somebody shoots comes within like a fraction of an inch of blasting your brains out on national television, and you just get up and fist pump and tell everybody you're going to be like, I'm just going to be worse from now on. Like that.
I mean, that was remarkable how quickly he got up and was immediately defiant. A lot of people would be traumatized, they'd be shaken, they'd be in a bad state at what had just happened.
Yeah, like you're on a different level of human existence when you do that. And I mean, look, you're rarely gonna lose out gambling on like nothing ever happens, saying like actually he'll try to do some stuff and he'll get obstructed and it really won't change anything. You're like, yeah, that is the safe bet, because that's saying I think the events will continue on as they have before. On the other hand, I don't think there's any, like, if there was ever a time where you could say, okay, we have actually had a break, history's going to shift now, things are going to be different. Like, I think that the last four years could be one of those moments. It feels like something that you read in your history book about, like, well, this was the end of this era and the beginning of this. And, like, as far as American politics go, it is objectively true that since 2016, this has been the Donald Trump era. Everything in American politics, except for like a stretch of maybe 2 years since then, has been all about Trump, about attacking Trump, about trying to get Trump out of office, trying to put Trump in jail, they tried to assassinate him. It has been all about him and will continue for the next 4 years, hopefully. I see no reason to blackpill about that. You know, just wait and see. After that first year, you'll have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's okay in the meantime to have some hope and have some optimism about it. And yeah, maybe we'll be admitting that we were very disappointed a year from now, or maybe not. Who knows? Okay, we should get to the super chats now. There have been quite a few. Alt White made a nice donation. Thank you very much for that. Winter Phoenix said, it seems they have discovered the current oldest hominid in Turkey. In addition to similar findings in Greece and Bulgaria, the fossil record has disproved the out-of-Africa theory, since these are over 5 million years older. There's also genetic evidence for this. Well, that's great, but I don't know how it relates to anything in this discussion. I'm not sure if that linked somehow, but anyway, thank you very much. Okay, Construct said, here's to Mr. White Tuber. Thank you very much.
Oh, by the way, white people are from the Antarctic region.
We didn't... from Hyperborea.
Yeah.
With the penguins. Darby said, not just southern state flags, but all the U.S. state flags seem to be getting changed to awful Google homepage slop. Who asked for this? Minnesota basically changed theirs to the Somali flag recently.
Yeah, they did.
Oh, that's grim. That's grim. And then Construct said, Nigel Farage is containment like Trump. If you look at the school enrollment statistics in England, children aged 5 years old, ethnically English school children barely make up 50%. Yeah, it's a bad situation. I take the point. It's a fucking depressing situation. Stephen said, it's probably 2% of Scots that are far left, 10% far right, and the rest don't care or are reality TV watching sheep. The problem is 9% of the 10% far right aren't actively waiting for things to get dramatically worse, or collapse. We're smart enough to realize there's no voting or democratic route out of this. Yeah, that's probably true. 2% far left. I'd probably go along with that. He then says he's from Glasgow and was in the Scottish Defence League. I remember a march in Edinburgh. The news showed 150 of us and 400 Antifa. However, I'll never forget driving through Edinburgh on the coach and local people literally lining the streets and clapping, waving at our coach. This was just after Lee Rigby was killed. That's interesting. That would have been about 2013, 2012. Yeah, the media always distort this. I always know whenever there's coverage of some demonstration, they will amplify the left-wing side of it, and they will demonize the right-wing side and diminish, try to alter the perception of it. It's very, very blatant, probably even more shameless here than it is in America.
I've got a hopefully kind of white pill theory. I've heard this from people who are smart and who have been connected. I don't know if this is true. I wouldn't know, but I'll put this out here. I mean, I've heard people that I've offered this for, and they've said, well, this is just ludicrously obvious that it's true. But I'll say this. The idea is that you talked about how genuinely right-wing the people of Scotland are. The idea is that many of the, almost all of these sort of countries and sort of the NATO West and stuff, are likely much more right-wing than we know. They're essentially being run by the United States State Department, which is, that's not even just Americans. That's not even just a slice of Americans. You know, Washington, D.C. voted for Kamala, like 95%. Not even just the 95%. Now the State Department is like the most liberal people on earth. And the idea is that these people essentially control all these sort of Western NATO states, things with the dollar and stuff like this. Now, this is just theory that I've heard to me. And that more or less, if the state, the United States State Department was able to be cleared out, which is things that have been essentially promised by, if not just Trump, but Elon and the quite young man who's likely to be the very next president. Presidential candidate for Republican Party have said this is a goal for them, that literally that we don't need to, like all in America has to do. I mean, all that has to happen for there to be a renaissance of sort of right wing politics and things like that in countries like Scotland or all these places is that. We're literally the United States State Department's boot to come off their neck, and they're just able to do what they want. I mean, if that sounds outlandish, I mean, just think of of just the absurdities that we've seen in like Irish politics and stuff. You know that the, like, you know, you were killing people, you're killing the Northern Irish to for this, and then now it's like, oh no, all we want is more African immigrants or whatever. I mean, well, it's a theory and it's a possibility that could happen in our lifetimes. And people say, well, nothing could ever happen. I mean, lots of things happen. I mean, you have to just think of the 20th century. Lots and lots of things happen. Entire ethnicities were moved from this state to that state. Where's Prussia, et cetera?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think people should keep an open mind about this. You never know. And in the meantime, you need to get through things. You need to get by it. Sure. So, yeah. All right. Well, let's leave it there. This has been very good. I should say, Stephen also added a quote from an old video of mine. I don't want to read it out. Times have changed, Stephen. I hope you understand. But thank you anyway. All right. Well, that's great. So I hope people check out your podcast. I think they've got a good flavor of how you are and your interaction, your chemistry, and the kind of things you talk about. So this has been really enjoyable. So,
If you got time, can I ask you a question real quick?
Yeah, sure.
Do you still have an affectation for vintage synthesizers?
I'm curious about them. I would never spend money to buy one because they cost a fortune. But I do know about them. Yeah, is there something in particular?
Well, have you seen? There's this a Chinese company, but unfortunately, they're called Behringer, and they have been remaking all of these super expensive vintage synths for much more reasonable prices. They're making them like exactly like they used to be. It's pretty incredible. I don't know, like, yeah. I can do nothing but, well, yeah,
they're headed by a guy who is really into it. So he's not just a money man sort of corporate drone. He really likes synthesizers. So as a result of that, they take it very seriously and they try to really replicate each one faithfully. I am curious about the Korg MS-20, and one day I might buy that, but I've got the Hydra synth and it does everything I need. So there we go. I mean, it is fun. And the classics, yeah, people are fond of them for good reason. It's not just like an affectation. They actually do have a lovely sound. So
yeah, I've got a Korg DW8000.
Oh, right. I think that's digital, isn't it? That's that late 80s.
It's old. It must weigh like 400 pounds. But
I've heard of it. I know it's not one off the top of my head, but
it's not one of the great classics. But I have a vintage synth. But anyways, I was just curious if you heard about it because it's just amazing. It'd be so much cheaper for them to not make them as authentic as they do, but they go all the way. It's crazy. But anyways,
yeah, I know. Well, I could talk about this at great length, but let's not, because most of my friends aren't into that stuff.
I understand.
All right. Okay. Well, let's leave it there. So this has been great. And I'll be back in about 10, 15 minutes with Hearthfire Radio. But in the meantime, good old Bog and Marek from Good Old Boys, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll see you all later.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. But how about giving something back to your tireless host? Commemorating 10 years of Millennial, this unique animated vector graphic is available as an NFT for one lucky owner, and only one. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.